Upgrade your laundry routine with a durable and reliable Maytag laundry pair at Lowe's. Like the new Maytag washer and dryer with performance-enhanced stain-fighting power designed to cut through serious dirt and grime. And what's great is this laundry pair is in stock and ready for delivery when you need it the most. Don't miss out. Shop Maytag in-store or online today at Lowe's.
All right. So we are here tonight to talk to Edward Ashton, my namesake. He doesn't know that, but he is. I don't know if you saw it. I did put out a review on it. I just finished Mal Goes to War. By the way, if you guys are interested in the book, it does not come out until the 9th. But that book was excellent. Got a 5-star review for me, and I don't hand out a lot of those. And I don't hand them out just because you're on the channel either. I actually thoroughly enjoyed that book. For those who maybe, you know, stumbled in here and, you know, they're on the wrong channel, can you give them the short story of who Edward Ashton is?
Sure. I am a simple syrup farmer who does cancer research on the side. I'm also the author of 6 novels, 5 of which you can actually purchase right now, one of which is currently in copy edits with my publisher. I also have written a large number of short stories. You can find them all on my website. They've been published in places ranging from Analog and Fireside Fiction to the newsletter of an Italian sausage company. I live in the middle of the woods in upstate New York. I spend a lot of time chopping wood and wandering around the woods with my dogs.
Yeah, I did check out your website. That list of short stories was impressive. I'd heard of a couple of your books, but I didn't realize you had quite that many short stories published.
Yeah, I've been at this for a while. I published my first professional piece in 1989. So, you know, it's been a long road.
That has been a chunk of time, more time than we'll care to dismiss since I was also around in 1989. So my other question for you, I think you kind of answered this. I like the fact that you said you do cancer research on the side, but
yeah, don't tell my boss I said on the side.
Yeah, no. Well,
he thinks it's on the front.
Well, if he's smart, he's watching this. But that's besides the point. One thing I do want to do, and I think you said this is part of it, you kind of answered it, but let me maybe more on your writing style. What does a day in the life of Edward Ashton look like?
It varies from day to day. I work from home. So, you know, typically I get up, I walk the dogs, I'll go, you know, a couple of miles in the woods with the dog, make sure that, you know, she's taking care of all of her business, sit down to work. I typically will sneak in some little writing bits and pieces during breaks from the day job. And then in the evenings, I usually, you know, take dogs out again, maybe go for a swim, and then, you know, sit down and do some writing before bedtime. I mean, that's basically the cycle.
Gotcha. And so for getting yourself into writing, I mean, obviously you've been writing for a while now, but what got you into that? What is your villain origin story as a writer?
Yeah, that's a tough one for me because I've been writing for as long as I can remember. My parents moved house some years ago, and when they did, they cleared out the attic and they sent me a box of stories that I had written when I must have been 6 or 7 years old, sort of scrawled in pencil on that sort of thick ruled note paper. Some really dark stuff. I was a very troubled child, apparently, based on some of that stuff. But, you know, that's where I got started. I was writing little stories for my teachers when I was in first and second and third grade, and I really just never stopped.
Gotcha. Ooh, okay, sorry. Had a little pop up there. I must have forgot. I thought I turned something off, but apparently it's running on my Twitch channel. So I apologize to anybody on Twitch. We'll pretend that's not happening. All right. One of the actually getting into, I obviously don't have the book. The book is not out yet. I do have Mickey 7 hanging out over my corner or over my shoulder there. But Mal Goes to War, you know, very much. I mean, you're into a lot of, I don't know if you would use the term like cybernetics, but there's implants, there's augmented humans. Do you, as a science fiction writer, Do you find it more difficult that you have to kind of try to make things realistic as to where a fantasy writer, and I love fantasy, so I'm not picking on them, but a fantasy writer is like, they flew. How'd they fly? Well, it was magic. And, you know, that's the explanation and you're done. Do you find that your science fiction readers really want a little bit more meat on the bones and it has to be at least somewhat realistic?
I mean, they definitely do, but that's okay because I do too, right? I'm a science fiction writer. I'm a science fiction reader. I'm a scientist. So I teach a graduate class in quantum physics at the University of Rochester every year. So I expect some amount of plausibility from the science fiction that I read, and I expect some amount of plausibility from the science fiction that I write. When I'm putting something, so for instance, in Mickey 7, you know, that this is a story that involves travel from one star to another. Mm. And I have a mechanism for doing that in the book, which is to use antimatter rocket and antimatter drive. That's something that we know about now. I didn't put in, you know, a warp drive or a magical wormhole thing because, you know, that I wanted to stay with things that are at least plausible based on our current physics. Now, I do take some liberties and stretch things. So, for instance, our understanding based on specific impulse that you can generate with a hypothetical antimatter drive, the maximum speed that you could obtain with that really is about 0.3 or 0.4 C. I have the ship moving, the Drakkar, which carries them, you know, across this voyage, moving at 0.9 C because I needed them to get there faster. I can't have them spending 20 years in transit or 30 years in transit. So I stretch things a little, but, you know, I'm not just making stuff up. And that's, to me, that's important. And I know even some science fiction writers don't really feel so bound by that, but I try to keep things in the realm of plausibility.
Which I appreciate. I actually lean more fantasy on a lot of my reading, but that's because of the fact that for whatever reason, again, if you say it's magic, my brain's like, okay, it's magic. But if I'm reading sci-fi, then the stories either got to kind of like mention something, but not try to get too in depth on what it is, or else I lose that ability to, and I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but, you know, to set aside disbeliefs. If I'm reading a sci-fi book and it gets like in depth and I'm like, then I start wanting to go, well, that doesn't make any sense. So there's very few science fiction books that I love. Mal Goes to War, by the way, is one of them. We've already mentioned.
Thank you.
But I'm a big Murderbot fan. Robert C. Cargill's, C. Robert Cargill's. I always mix that up. Sea of Rust is another one. But yeah, I'm not really big into the sci-fi. But like I said, when I read your book, the way that you wrote it, the story that's there, and by the way, the sarcasm, I love Mal. Mal's one of my new favorite inorganic protagonists.
He's a fun guy.
Yeah, it was great. The story went along. I never hit anything where I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Or I never felt too, and this is getting away from the science fiction part, but you very much wrote that book where I never felt like anything was out of character. Mal, this is a short amount of time. Mal's the same guy. His attitudes change a little bit, but Mal's the same guy. He's an AI at the beginning as he is at the end. And I kind of loved that. He's still very true to himself. Did you have any, who was your biggest maybe influence when you were writing Mal? Was there something that sparked that particular story in your mind?
It's hard for me to attribute, to one particular thing. I'm a voracious reader. I read a ton of stuff. I read a book or two every week. And, you know, over the course of the year that I was working on this book, obviously, I read an enormous amount of stuff. And I don't recall who it was, but there was an essay I read by a writer many years ago where he said, your food tastes like whatever was sitting next to in the freezer. And meaning that, you know, when you're reading someone else, that is to a certain extent going to color your writing during that period of time while you're reading that. And so, I'm sure there were lots of different influences that stuck in there. But I would hope, and I would like to think that the voice is still my own throughout. It's I feel like I have a pretty distinct voice that comes across in all my books, and I think I held that pretty well for this one.
I also loved, as a person, as you mentioned, 1989 earlier, as a person who grew up in that genre, that age, some of your, I don't know if you want to call them shout outs or whatever, but like one of your AIs is named Clippy. It's, those of us a certain age immediately recognize Clippy. Mm-hmm. I think some of the younger readers would be like, what the heck are you talking about? But I loved a lot of your throwbacks. You seem to have like those little comments. Bethsaida was the name of a city. I don't know if everybody's going to get that one. But obviously the software company is the first thing. Was that intentional? I thought of the software company when you named the city Bethsaida.
No, that's Bethesda. That's an actual city. Yeah. You know,
did I misread that this whole time?
Yeah, maybe.
Oh possible. My goodness. I probably misread that whole time. Cause my brain just went to Bethsaida.
Yeah. Because that's where the NIH is located. And you know, the NIH is sort of one of the centers of the plot there. So yeah, that also.
And I do remember, you mentioned the NIH in there. Well, I can't believe I misread that this entire time now.
Yeah, it's just a couple letters.
Man, the brain reads what the brain wants to read. My apologies. Although it was still fun, so I still enjoyed it. So where else was it? I'm trying to avoid spoilers on this book because there's way too much. I think there's way too many things that might be spoiler-ish, and I don't want to mess it up for people who haven't read it yet. You do have an ending that I feel like you could revisit this world that you've created, but I also feel like it was very much standalone possible. It very much wrapped itself up towards the end. Do you have a plan of revisiting Mal in the future?
So this is something that someone at my stage of a writer's career has to deal with all the time. If you are, you know, if you're John Scalzi or you know, N.K. Jemisin, you can go to your publisher and say, I'm writing a 6-book opus. And they will say, thank you very much. We are happy to have your 6-book opus. I can't do that. So the ability to write a sequel or a series for me is entirely dependent on how well the first book sells. If the first book, because the basic assumption of a publisher is that each subsequent book in a series will sell a fraction of the sales of the previous book in that series, because some of the people who read the previous book won't like it and will not buy the subsequent one. And nobody who didn't buy the previous book is going to buy the subsequent one. So if they're not 100% sure that your first book is going to be a blockbuster, they're not going to sign you to write a series right up front. Now, I always like to leave a little room. So if you read Mickey 7, you know Mickey 7 is a complete standalone novel. If there were never anything else in that world, you would have a complete story and nobody, I think, would be sad or disappointed. Mm. There's no cliffhangers, there's no loose ends, there's nothing. But I left a little hook that I could hang a sequel on if I wanted to. And
good.
You know, that book's done well enough that my publisher was happy to publish a sequel to it, which is what Any Matter Blues is.
Right.
With Mal Goes to War, again, it's a complete novel. It's a standalone. If there's never anything else in this universe, no one, I think, will have any reason to be sad. But you're right. I did leave myself a little opening in case I want to come back to it. Because you never know when you're going to want to come back and revisit your old friends.
Exactly. Well, like I said, I love the characters in it. So I don't get a say in the matter other than the fact that I do plan on getting a physical copy of the book too, not just the arc. But I would love to see Mal and friends and maybe get a little bit more Clippy and some of those other guys, if it's possible. Mal left a little bit of that open at the end too. It's like, is he being serious or is he not being serious? And that's all I'm going to say about the end of the book. But yeah, he definitely seemed like he said something, but did he say it just to mess with him? I wasn't quite 100% sure, but I feel like you did that intentionally. So if anybody's not looking for a series, and I know some people hate series, I think some of them have gotten too big. And so they're just like, oh, I don't want to start a series. Or we have these series of authors we shall not name. Everybody knows who I'm thinking of. that have never seemed to be finished. And so if you want a standalone, this one definitely, definitely sits perfectly well as a standalone. Was there anything? I feel like, what was the other one too? Oh my goodness, I knew I was going to forget it. I meant to write it down. There's a book you wrote before Mickey 7. I can kind of picture, it's almost like a, it's, was it like a Skull and Crossbones type thing on the cover?
3 days in April. Yeah, 3 days in April.
So I've seen you gone the, like, and I believe those were also quote unquote augmented humans. Is there something about that, cybernetics or something like that? I know you're in cancer research, but is there something about that type of character that intrigues you, where you've gone to this augmented human type thing a couple of times?
I mean, I just think it's neat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like the old Marge Simpson meme with the potato. You know, I just think they're neat. But and also I think it's where we're going. I mean, okay. When I wrote 3 days in April, you know, that book came out in 2015. And one of the things that I said in interviews that I was giving at that time was I really wanted to get this book published quickly so that it would be science fiction and not historical fiction, because there's nothing in that book that I don't think is going to be reality in the next, you know, 40 or 50 years. I feel like we are, I was just at a conference last week where they were demonstrating nerve bridges for patients who have suffered spinal cord injuries, where you have a cybernetic implant that basically picks up the nerve signals above the injury and transmits them to the nerves below the injury. And so you're able to reestablish control of, you know, if your lower limbs after you've had a complete spinal cord break. That's a first step towards sort of machine brain interface. You know, Elon Musk famously is working on direct machine brain interface. We've already mm-hmm. seen examples of people with primates as well as with humans of using brain implants to, you know, sort of move chess pieces around a chessboard. We're already down that road, and we're not going to slow down or go backwards. It's going to continue to accelerate, in my opinion.
I think too, that's one of the things that attracts people to science fiction is how many things that were science fiction at one point in time that basically sometimes give the scientists the idea for the things that we, I mean, people don't think of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea as being science fiction, but there wasn't that type of submarine mm-hmm. back then. It was complete science fiction at the time. I was just also thinking too, as a person who grew up in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, $6 Million Man, a lot of that stuff, you know, this is stuff that has been science fiction for a long time, but you're right. A lot of it is stuff that we never figured out. How would they ever do that? And the scientists are catching up. They're figuring out how to do some of this stuff.
Well, and a lot of science fiction writers like me are scientists themselves. And so, you know, we've got an eyeball on what's coming. We're already working with sort of the cutting edge of these sorts of technologies. And so it's pretty easy to extrapolate where they're going to wind up.
Well, like I said, hopefully someday somebody's going to be reading your book and wanting to know what you knew ahead of time because of the fact that, you know, it's live now and it's here. Mm-hmm. Especially spinal cord injuries is one of those things that we've never had the ability to really do anything about. And it's neat to see that we're getting to a point where those answers are coming down the track for us. So, like I said, I am trying desperately to avoid spoilers because I like this book so much. I want people to discover it as they go. Is there anything that you want to say about the book that, you know, maybe avoid spoilers and maybe you're not as scared to spoil something as I am since you are the author?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can talk a little bit about what the book's about, at least. Mal Goes to War is, in its essence, a fish out of water story, except the fish is an artificial intelligence and the water he's out of is essentially the internet. He's an artificial intelligence that sort of lives jumping from server to server, the sort of classic idea of a free AI, except because war breaks out and the infrastructure that supports all that network starts degrading, it's being destroyed, he finds himself trapped in the body of a deceased cyborg mercenary and responsible for the safety of the young girl that the mercenary had been had died defending, basically. And initially, really doesn't have much sympathy for humans on either side. Actually describes the war as similar to a battle between two anthills, as far as he's concerned. It's not, he doesn't really feel like he has any dog in this fight. But you know, you said he's the same guy at the end as he was at the beginning. I don't 100% think that that's true during his interactions, because he's trapped and finds himself responsible for this, you know, this young person. He does develop a sense of empathy with the humans around him, and eventually a sense of responsibility. I think he does have a bit of a character arc and a little bit of growth, a little bit of emotional growth and development. And you know, essentially the main plot of the story is Mal and this girl Kaylee and the assorted hangers on that accumulate to them, trying to escape the war zone, trying to get safe behind federal lines and out of the line of fire, with not much success and running through many sort of hazards and dangers.
That reminds me too, and I did do like, I think I did like a 6-minute review on it. One of the things you'd called him, by the way, Mal also referred to the humans as monkeys, which kind of gave an idea of how he felt about them. Mm-hmm. But I felt too that you wrote for, it seemed like a short story. Sometimes I read chonkers. But in the fact that you had such a short story, I felt like you did a good job too. Some of your characters are likable, unlikable characters, if you know what I mean. For instance, I start to care a little bit about Pullman. You guys read the book, you'll find out who Pullman is. Pullman, in certain ways, is very unlikable, but there's also certain parts where he's also very real. He's got an implant, and you know, he gets very, very, very upset about people talking about what that implant is for. So, like I said, there's that part that makes him very human. He's not just a jerk. But he's also in a situation where some of the things where Mal's like, why don't you do this? It's also very understandable to why Pullman, as who he is. Okay, that's easy for you to say. You know, I've got this. You're telling me to go, and I'm going to make up a scenario here just so people can get an idea of what I'm saying. Let's say you've got a character that is, you know, he seems to me at least to be, I don't know if they say his age, but he seems to be an older gentleman. You know, he's not a weekend warrior type guy. And all of a sudden there is an army there, and you're basically telling him, go fight the army. With what? You know, poor Pullman gets put in these situations where he almost can't help but be himself. So that I feel like that humanity makes him likable, but also you kind of see he's also a big scaredy cat. So he's kind of likable and unlikable at the same time, which I feel is really hard to pull off as an author. And I feel like him, Asher, there's a couple of them where you give them, they're not one-dimensional or two-dimensional. I mean, they're fully developed three-dimensional characters. So there's parts of them where you kind of like, oh, he's a jerk, for any of your characters almost. And then other parts where you're like, he's also a human being, and I get that. There's not a single character, even Kaylee, as cute as she is, Kaylee still has an attitude. So the fact that you made a group of characters in such a short time, all three-dimensional, it's hard to develop sometimes in what I consider, it's 304 pages, anybody who hasn't read it. To me, that's a short book. I know some people may not think that. But I feel like you did a lot of development in a very small time to make us care about these people at the end.
Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate what you're saying about likability. I've had that discussion sometimes with some of my critique partners. One of them in particular, very frequently says, you know, I wish you make this or that character. I just wanted to really, like, can't you give him a special talent? I want him so that I can have something to like admire about them and love them. And I don't really do. I don't write pure good people. I don't write superheroes. I don't write pure evil people. I don't believe in pure evil people or pure good people. I try to write human beings, as realistic human beings as I can make them. As I myself am, and as I see people in the world, I am not a perfect person by any stretch. I've done a lot of good things in my life, and I've probably done some bad things in my life. And I think that's probably true for every one of us. And I want that to be true of the characters in my books as well. I want them to, you know, have things that you can like about them, have things you can admire about them, but also have things that you find kind of disgusting about them, because there are some things that are, you know, maybe not so admirable about every single one of us. There's none of us who can look back on every single thing that they've done in their life and every character trait that they have and say, yeah, I am the bee's knees. I'm just perfect top to bottom. That's not real. And to me, that's not an interesting character. If somebody's just like a, you know, in Dungeons and Dragons, a paladin character, they're like lawful good, and that's not an interesting character to me. You know, I want to see somebody who's doing good things despite their flaws, mm-hmm. and with realistic motivations. And, you know, maybe they actually don't want to be doing the heroic thing, but they're kind of compelled to for reasons that may be partly out of their control. To me, and they do it anyway, even though they're afraid, and even though they may not be, you know, super talented or really well suited to whatever this job is, they do it anyway because it's what they have to do in the circumstance. And to me, that's a much more interesting character than somebody who is just like fearless and goes out and does the brave thing because they feel no fear.
And one thing I was impressed too, that I thought when I'm looking back on the book, now that I've read it, a lot of times when you're reading a book, if you're reading, for instance, 007, you know, 007 is going to be around at the end of the book, you know, and sometimes that loses the tension. You managed to write Mal in such a way that when Mal was in trouble, as a reader, you're so engaged in it, you're actually feeling like, how's he going to get out of this one? You know, let's face it, certain people, like some guy with two R's in the middle of his name, have made it now where you can't always be sure a character's going to survive to the end, no matter how much you like him. And I felt like, intellectually, did I know Mal goes to war, Mal's probably going to be fine? Yes. But in the middle of reading it, you didn't make him that super powered character. He had flaws, and not only did he have flaws, but he also had very much limitations that were put on him. I loved, and nobody who hasn't read the book's going to understand this. You'll read the book, you'll get it. I love the poor scenes for Mal when, for instance, Pullman went to sleep. The situation you put him in, because I can imagine that situation. I'm like, I would be bored out of my skull. But yeah, you had some very good stories in there, and you had stuff that I feel, and I'm not saying that I'm not an author, obviously, but I do read a lot, and you had certain situations like that where I'm thinking, I'm not sure everybody would have thought of that. That game, for instance, he invents to keep himself busy. It has like four different iterations. And the fact that it's like, okay, I'm bored just listening to this game, but he's doing that for entertainment. Because it really gave you this character depth. It gave him, you wanted to, even when there wasn't action going on, you still had my interest, which is sometimes hard to do in this day and age. We've all got that Twitter, you know, TikTok attention span. And, you know, for 300 pages of that book, I couldn't wait to get to the next page.
I really appreciate that. And I do feel like there's a lot of action in this book. I don't give the impression that, you know, it's just sort of a slow moving lazy river. It's not. But yeah, it can't be go, 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 go every minute of the day. And so I do try to slip in little parentheticals that make even the downtime at least have some sort of interest to them or some sort of amusement to them. And it seems like you picked up on a little of that, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, and nobody get me wrong, there was a lot of action in this book. I'm simply saying, I know a lot of authors, sometimes you'll have an author that feels like they've got to have that constant action and there's no downtime to keep the story moving. Or you find the ones that want to spend 60 pages describing the fauna. And there is that happy medium. And I feel like your pacing, and I think that's the hardest thing to quantify or qualify when you're trying to discuss a book, but your pacing was excellent. As here's the action, okay, here's the downtime, but we're also not bored. We're discussing things, we're talking about things, we're inside. Most of this book is inside Mal's head. In fact, I think there was only one brief chapter that wasn't from his point of view. So a lot of times, like I said, sometimes in other books, I've seen that part get slow. And when you slowed it down, and you have to slow it down or else you don't have that emotional roller coaster. When you slowed it down, I still was interested and I still couldn't wait to get to the next part. Not because I'm bored out of my mind, I want to get to the next part, but like, where are we going with this? So again, and I tell people all that, or telling people since I read this book, this is one of those weird books where this is a science fiction beach read to me, in the fact that it's a short book, it's quickly paced, you just keep going and you're done with the book before you know it. And I don't want to use beach read in the negative connotation. Sometimes you want that book where I don't want to have to sit here and with a thesaurus, for instance, which science fiction, sometimes you have to have a textbook next to you. What is he talking about? But, you know, this is one of those ones where for somebody who's not deep, deep science fiction nerd, and as a nerd, I feel like I can use that word. This is something that a more casual science fiction fan could still pick up and enjoy.
That's exactly what I'm shooting for. You know, I enjoy things like N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy. Okay. I love that trilogy. It's brilliant. N.K. Jemisin is absolutely brilliant writer. But it's heavy and it's dense. Mm-hmm. You're going to sit down and read N.K. Jemisin. You need to like find yourself a quiet space and make sure you're like focused in and dialed and ready to do some heavy mental work. That's not me. That's not my style. I want to be, I have serious things to say. Mm-hmm. And I think all of my books have serious points to make, but I do try to keep it a little more light and breezy for the most part. I want you to be able to blow through this book in a day and a half or 2 days and say at the end, wow, that just flew by. I don't know where the time went. That's kind of my goal. Not everybody wants to write that way. Not everybody wants to read that kind of book. Obviously, there, you know, if what you really want is something that's gonna, you know, like you say, make you pull out a thesaurus and ponder over the meaning of every sentence. Yeah, I highly recommend the Broken Earth trilogy. That's it'd be a great book for you. Maybe go check out Gravity's Rainbow. That's another good one. But I don't mind the characterization of a beach read for my books. Mm. I think everybody on beaches should have copies of my books. That would be a fantastic thing.
It would be great. Like I said, sometimes too, I feel like there's certain stories that you need that are there. Everybody's got a gateway book. I feel like everybody who likes any genre probably didn't like that genre until they read X, whatever X is. Mm-hmm. And I feel like for me, when I say beach reads, I'm talking about ones that get you easy into it, where you can start falling in love with the series. Mal Goes to War, Murderbot. I know there's a lot of people that aren't huge sci-fi fans that love the Murderbot series by Martha Wells. There's just that type of story that draws you in and gets you excited and maybe takes you that farther down the road. I did read M.K. Jemisin's fifth season. I have not finished that series yet. And again, I love that one too, but yeah, I'm not sitting down and reading fifth season in an afternoon, you know,
no,
laying out by the pool.
It's hard work. It's hard work. And that's okay. I mean, you know, that's, mm-hmm. there's a time and a place for books like that. And I love books like that, but you know, there's a time and a place for the kind of stuff that I write too.
Gotcha. Now I know we are, I'm not going to get much into it. I'm going to just touch on it briefly, because I know right now, obviously Mal Goes to War, dropping April 9th. Just going to say that again, let everybody know. is what we're studying on. But also keep in mind down the road, if you haven't read Mickey 7 yet, you need to get it read because the movie's coming out, I believe, in January. That's all I'm going to touch on that. Hopefully, maybe you and I can get together when that gets a little closer. I'd love to see maybe what your thought of is the movie after you see it. I don't know if you get to, see it before, ahead of time or anything. A lot of people don't. But that's all I'm going to say about that. Because, again, if you want to read Mickey 7, Antimatter Blues, you said, is also the sequel to that as well. You've got books that I feel like somebody who maybe has always said that I don't want to get into sci-fi, I feel like your books, people can get into sci-fi.
Yeah, I mean, my test always, one of the first things that I do is if my wife will read the book. My wife does not like sci-fi. She is not a sci-fi fan at all. And so if she'll read my book and has fun with it, I know I've hit the target that I'm shooting for, because I'm not intending to target this only at hardcore sci-fi fans. I think hardcore sci-fi fans would enjoy some of the stuff that I write. But I really would like to be accessible to a broader audience as well. And so I try to steer away from the sort of things where you have to already know the tropes to understand what the book is talking about. So my target is always if somebody who has never picked up a sci-fi book in their life could pick it up and read through it and understand exactly what I'm talking about. And I feel like I've hit that mark for the most part with my past books, at least based on the feedback I've gotten from some of my very non sci-fi fan friends.
One other thing I was just thinking about it too, and this is getting back to Mal Goes to War. Anybody who is looking at a title like Mal Goes to War and they're like, oh, I don't like military, or I'm a pacifist, or you name it whatsoever, you managed to write a book where two factions are at war. And as a reader, you don't agree with either one of them. You never feel that either one of them is necessarily 100% evil, but you're not necessarily rooting for either side either. You're more looking at this like, and I think I introduced when I did the review for this book, it's like, it's 2065 and the humans are fighting amongst themselves. Shocker. They always find something to fight about, but you don't see too many stories that have war as a background, unless it's like a really gritty, almost a nonfiction type, or a story about the tragedies of war. But you wrote this book that, yes, he finds himself plopped in a war, but again, there's no good side. There's no side to pick. You're siding with the people who are like, leave me out of this war. I want nothing to do with this. Was that a background idea that you wanted to have him plopped in the middle of a war where there wasn't a good guy to root for?
Yeah. My model for a war novel would be something like, Kurt Vonnegut or Joseph Heller, right? Catch 22, Slaughterhouse 5, things like that. Where really what you're talking about is the absurdity of the idea of war to begin with. There's no heroes in this. There's no grand crusades. It's just waste and senseless destruction on both sides. And there's no absolute bad guy, just sort of like with my characters. There's no absolute bad guy. There's no absolute good guy. Everybody has their motivations. Some are better, some are worse. Everyone takes things too far. There's no way to fight a war without committing atrocities. There's just not. And those are, atrocities are committed on both sides. Very, very similar to the way that Vonnegut portrays. I mean, Vonnegut obviously had the experience of being an infantryman in World War II. Heller also fought in World War II. And that I think was a very scarring event for them. But I think is a sensibility that I really absorbed through my reading. I'm a huge Vonnegut fan. Tim O'Brien, another real hero of mine. If you've ever read Going After Cacciato or the things that they carried, you know, talking about Vietnam, you know, that just presenting the entire sort of exercise as an exercise in absurdity is the way that I wanted to approach this. And again, I feel like I mostly hit the mark.
I think you hit the mark pretty darn well, because I always appreciate it when you get to the end of a book and you realize something like that, because that also means you didn't, you know, pick it up with your Bible of choice and thump somebody over the head with it either. I never read the whole war thing as like, war is horrible, we should never have a war, if you like war, you're an idiot, blah, blah, blah. It was never preachy. It was just, you went through this and you got to the end of it, is like, do these guys even know what they're fighting about? Because you think about it, do we know why they were both fighting? Yes, but it was really about forcing the other one, without getting into details, to accept their ideals. It wasn't that, for instance, the Federalists, I didn't feel like were forcing anything on the Humanists, but the Humanists didn't like what the Federalists were doing, and so they just decided, we're going to fight each other, even though we could have just left each other alone, and you do your thing, and that's fine, and we decide not to do it, and that's fine. But they disagreed, and as is way too often the case, if we disagree about something these days, we have to scream at each other until somebody throws something, and now there's a war. But like I said, I really appreciated the fact that the lesson to be learned in your book was not front and center. Is you had this story, and at the end, hopefully you learned something on accident while you were reading.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that turns a reader off faster than whacking him over the head with a moral. Nobody wants to be preached at when they're trying to be entertained when they're reading a novel. And I'm not interested in preaching at anyone. And so, like I said, I have my ideas. I have my own opinions. They certainly make their way into my writing. And I do try to get some things across. But my main goal with any book is to write an entertaining and engaging story. And if I'm sneaking in some little bits and pieces of my own worldview at the same time, that's sort of a side thing, but it's also the good, but it's not the main point of the book.
No, but it's definitely hard. I don't think every author can pull that balance off where this is entertaining, but also maybe a little educational. You know, if you get to the end of the book, you're going to have learned something whether you intended to or not. I won't mention any names. I don't like dissing on authors, but I have read books where 5 pages into it, it's like, okay, I know exactly what your point is in making this book.
Yeah.
And then you can't see past it. Especially, I read one book, which I will not name. I read it for a book club. None of us liked it, even though it was a bestseller. But you felt like this person wrote a book thinking, I'm only ever going to write one book, and so I'm going to get every political viewpoint of mine in, even if it's just in passing, just so I can say I wrote about it. And it was just page after page after page after page. It's like, is there a story in here somewhere?
My observation has been that a lot of times where you see that is with older famous authors who have garnered enough influence and power that their editors can no longer pull that stuff out of their books for them. You know, so you see a lot of sort of lions of the field in their later works. They get, you know, they sort of go off the rails with, you know, being extremely politically preachy or, you know, pushing their little sort of pet scientific ideas or whatever.
Right.
With in ways that if they were in an earlier part of their career, an editor would have stomped on and said, this is, you can't do this. But once this, you know, once you're a, you know, multi-million book best-selling author, you know, your editor, I think, maybe has a little more trouble reining you in. So that's been my observation. So if I ever get that way, I hope that somebody will pull the plug on me. I'm going to try really hard not to.
All right. If I see you writing, get off my lawn, I'll let you know.
I appreciate that.
But yeah, this one was actually surprisingly a much younger author. It was like, I think it was a debut novel, and I was just kind of like, again, it also depends. Does your editor agree with you politically, regardless of which side of the thing are you on? So yeah, I felt like they had a, and I'm using they intentionally to avoid, I don't want to give anything away about who it is, But like I said, it was big enough that we read it for a book club, and it was just so baseball bat over your head every single chapter. It just drove me crazy. It's like if you wanted to bring something like, if they brought up one thing or two things and it fit in the story, fine. But I felt like they took things and they wrapped the story around it to make their point instead of the other way around. But we're getting off topic. We're talking to Edward Ashton here. We're talking about Mal Goes to War. If you haven't seen my review, watch my review. This book is absolutely worth it. Like I mentioned in the review, and I've said it earlier here, just in case somebody's coming late, 304 of the easiest, most fun pages you've ever read in a science fiction novel, talking about some stuff that's, you know, it's actually on the horizon, but we managed to get to read about it in this novelization. And again, I think you talked about the fact that a lot of science fiction writers are scientists. I also feel like a lot of scientists were science fiction fans when they were kids, and some of these ideas and things were taking shape are such of interest to them. It's like, I've got to learn more about that, and they just fall in love with it.
Oh, there's definitely a feedback loop there. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure my love of science fiction when I was a very young kid probably had a lot to do with the career path that I wound up going down.
Do you find it's difficult? Like I said, you talked about the fact that you do cancer research, which to me sounds very time consuming and very brain heavy. Do you find that the cancer research, like I said, I know you do a lot of science reading and that's given you some of the ideas possibly, but do you also feel like that leaves very little time and maybe mental energy for the writing process?
You know, that's never been a problem for me. From talking to other writers, I've gotten the impression that the way that I'm able to work is pretty unusual. But my style of writing, I've described as writing the interstices. So I'm not the sort of person who needs 3 hours of quiet and calm in a darkened room to sit down and write, to get myself into headspace or whatever. My first novel was basically written with a sandwich in one hand, typing with the other hand during lunch breaks at work. That's how I got it. And I finished the entire book in about 6 months working in that way. As I'm going through my day, if I had 20 minutes of downtime, I just put a roast in the oven. It's going to be in there for 30 minutes. That's 500 words. I can bang out 500 words in 30 minutes. No problem. Just while I'm waiting for it to cook. I've got lunch break at work, or I've got, 20 minutes downtime in between two meetings. That's 150, 200 words. And those words accrete, they accumulate. And the trick is being able to flip your brain back and forth between, here I'm talking about, a kinase inhibitor for work, and then immediately flipping over to, okay, now I'm talking about an artificial intelligence who's gotten trapped in a molding severed head that's getting eaten by a dog. To be able to flip that switch really quickly seems natural, normal to me, but from talking to the writers, I've determined that that's not something that most people are able to do quite so fluidly. So I think that's the thing that allows me to be as productive as I am, despite, having a bunch of other stuff going on in my life.
Yeah, the fact that I'm married to a nurse is the only reason I even followed that sentence you just said anyhow in the first place. It's like inhibitors. I kind of know what that is. I would say, based on the ones authors I've talked to, that, yeah, I do feel like you have a bit of a difference there. Almost every author I know who is either become famous but kept their day job because they love it, or isn't making enough money on the writing, which, let's face it, is more authors than as we have this fantasy that authors make all these millions of dollars. I'm going to blame Brandon Sanderson for that, but it's not the truth. And the fact that most of you have day jobs, most of you, and I'm saying that as authors as a group, do need, from what I can tell, do need that completely separate downtime, maybe before work or after work. I don't feel like a lot of them could write on their lunch break. If I wrote on my lunch break, and I'm not an author, but if I wrote on my lunch break at the end of 6 months, I might have a book of like 3 or 4 poems. I definitely would not have a fully functional, sci-fi story going on in my head. So that is impressive. I know that you probably don't feel like it is because that's just your style. That's what works for you. But yeah, it does seem like an outlier to me from based on the people I've talked to.
You say impressive. I don't think it's impressive. It's just different, mm-hmm. And it's not better. It's different. So like to me, I hear my author friends talking about how, I sat down on Saturday and I had a 6,000 or 7,000 word day. I've never written 7,000 words in a week ever in my life, let alone in one day. I can't imagine sitting down and banging out 7,000 words in a single day. To me, that sounds like witchcraft. To them, being able to do the stuff that I do probably sounds a little bit like witchcraft. I think it's more just, all of our brains work in different ways and we work with what nature has given us.
But with the fact that you say you haven't written 7,000, and I don't, obviously there might be some hyperbole in there, but you haven't written 7,000 in a week. The fact that you're still talking about getting these novels out in, or at least having written them in 6 months to a year, it sounds like most of yours are roughly in that space. Again, there's a whole lot of consistency there, if nothing else. Maybe you're not sitting down on a weekend and knocking out 6,000 words, but to write a 300-page book in, 6 months to a year, and you're filling it in this time, the consistency to be able to do that is, if nothing else, it's probably a lot more. Why is my brain failing me today? Not persistence, but.
Now, I think persistence is the word you're looking for. And this is something that's been sort of a hallmark of my life. I was, I went to school on athletic scholarship, as an endurance athlete. I was a runner and a swimmer. And I swam like the 1,000 and the 1650. I was a long distance swimmer. I did triathlons, after college, and I made beer money doing triathlons. So just sort of being able to be persistent at something, training consistently when I was doing triathlons, writing consistently, never sprinting, never sort of flying ahead, but just grinding, for a longer period of time than other people can tolerate, basically, has always kind of been my superpower. I was never, the fastest or the strongest, but I could keep going longer than anybody. And, when I was in college, I could keep going and suffer longer than anybody, basically. There's something to be said for that. There's a skill to that. So yeah, when you can write a book in 6 months at 500 words a day, if you write 500 words a day every single day. And that's what I do. I'm consistent and I write at pace. I don't sit down and do 10,000 words in a day, but if you're writing 300, 400, 500, 600 words a day, every single day, it does, it adds up to a book in about 6 months.
Yeah, I think discipline was the word I was looking for, but the persistence works very well.
That's another word for it.
All right. So I kind of think if there's anything else to talk about Mal without getting too deep into it. Like I said, I'll just say one more time, great cast of characters, great story, great pacing. For those of you who don't like a big fat book, I read Swan Song. It's over 1,000 pages. It's not for everybody. But if you like that 300, which seems to be, and I'll tell you this story too, because when I saw the number 304, it kind of reminded me, I used to work at a bookstore and we actually had a book club of little old ladies who were, if they were looking for a book and they opened it and it was over 300 pages, they put it down and looked for another book. I mean, that was like, this is our limit. Your book, I feel too, is in that sweet spot that nobody's going to pick it up and like, oh man, this is so big. Because there are people who are afraid of big books.
Yeah. I mean, I write the books that is sort of length that I write because that's the length of book that I like to read. I do not like picking up a book and seeing a doorstop. I do not like a 1,000-page book. It seems like a really big commitment to me. It's the same reason I don't like really long series. Like you get into The Wheel of Time, you've just committed yourself for the next 10 years. You know, I mean, you've made like a lifetime commitment to that book. Mm-hmm. And I don't trust that way. I've got a lot, life is short and there's lots of other stuff to read and lots of other stuff to see. And I don't want to spend the next 10 years of my life grinding through one single story.
Yeah, I'll admit, I think I petered out about book 6 on Wheel of Time, to be honest.
It's hard not to.
Oh, man. So, all right. Yeah, I can't remember what the other thing I was going to say. So, get into a few other questions just that I kind of ask every author. And also, if you're watching this on Twitch, if you go over to watch the YouTube thing later, I'll have links in on YouTube to Edward's page, the other Edward, not me. So like I said, make sure that book comes out next week. Make sure you grab it. What, if anything, are you working on right now that you can talk about?
Right now, what I'm working on is my next book. So I'm under contract for one more book with my publisher, Macmillan, and St. Martin's Press. It's it's a standalone novel. It's not related to any of my previous work. It is set on a future Earth, not like a super near future Earth, but a future Earth where mankind has been shunted aside and essentially domesticated by another species. I don't want to say a ton about it, but the story revolves around a relationship between essentially a domesticated human and he calls himself his employer, but it's unclear whether this is sort of his employer, his friend, or his owner. They get into a bunch of wacky shenanigans, as one might expect, and you learn a lot more about how this situation came to be as the story goes along. It is, like most of my books, it's going to have a lot of comedic elements to it, but again, some serious things to say, and you know, hopefully will be another sort of distinct set of characters and interesting characters to add to my collection.
Gotcha. And if you missed it earlier, the comedy, the sense of humor, especially by Mal, was one of the things that it totally endeared me to that book. What special skill or talent, I feel like some of this we may have already talked about, do you have that maybe people don't know about that you wish people would know about you or that you'd like to talk about?
I do make really good maple syrup. I live in the part of upstate New York that has moose and maple syrup, not Manhattan. And we tap our trees every year. This year wasn't a great season. Honestly, you might've read that there's like a shortage of maple syrup in Canada right now. Maple syrup is derived from the sap. Maple trees, the sap only runs when you have very specific weather conditions. You have to have cold nights and relatively warm days. Basically, you need a freeze thaw cycle. And that's what creates a hydrostatic pressure that draws the sap up through the trees. And we didn't have very much of a cold spring this year. So I wound up getting about 3 gallons of syrup out of about 160 gallons of sap this year, which is a pretty light year, honestly. But it's enough to keep me in my diabetes. So I'm feeling okay about that.
Yeah, I'm working to stay out of that myself. I did have to laugh a little in my head, though, when you said it was a bad year for maple syrup. I just had like this whole wine tasting thing in my head. It's like, ooh, maple syrup. Oh, it's a 22. That was a good year.
No, we just didn't get as much. You know, we didn't get as much sap as we nearly would.
All right. So what are you reading right now, if you don't mind sharing?
I just finished reading a book, Tim O'Brien's new book. It's called America Fantastica. I don't know if you've seen this one lying around or if you're very familiar with Tim O'Brien, but Tim O'Brien is one of the most distinct voices in American literature. In my opinion, he has a very unique style. All of his books have had these sort of common elements. They always have a really traumatized protagonist with an extremely troubled past that you learn that gets doled out to you bit by bit as you go through the book. They always have a cast of really wacky side characters, which this one has in spades. The plots of his books always edge up to, and somebody sometimes cross over into surrealism, which this one absolutely does. I described this book to one of my friends as the most Tim O'Brien book that Tim O'Brien ever Tim O'Brien'd. I 100% stand by that assessment. It's brilliant. It's funny. It's, you know, as I aspire to, it's got some things to say about contemporary American society that probably we need to hear. So if you're looking for, if you're looking for a read, I would highly recommend this one.
Well, see, now you found my super secret plan. That's why I actually have this. I get to talk to authors whose books I already love, to find out more books from my TBR pile, to find, you know, ask them what books they love. So it's really, you know, it's all for me. Let's see, anything else we got coming up here? Trying to see if there's anything I haven't. Oh, yeah. One question I always like to ask, is there anything that, any question that you might've been expecting or anything that you want to talk about that has not been brought up yet?
I was a little surprised you didn't ask more about the movie. That seems to be what people are mostly interested in when they talk to me. You know, everybody wants to talk about the movie.
I asked you ahead of time, and the fact that, you know, because the movie got pushed back, originally I was going to, you know, talk a little bit about it, because not only is Mal coming out next week, but Mickey 17, is that the name of the movie?
Yep.
Because they changed it a little bit. Mickey 17 was supposed to have dropped last week, and so I thought it'd be a good, you know, chance to get your opinion on it. But since it's not coming out until, I think last thing I saw was January.
Yep,
so January. I wasn't going to spend a whole lot of time on that. I would love maybe to get back with you. You don't have to answer me now. I'm not putting you on the spot, but I'd love maybe to talk to you when that gets a little closer, or even after that comes out, just to see how you felt about that. And also to talk a little bit more about Mickey 7 at that time.
Well, you could talk about my next book too. I mean, that they've got that plan to come out right around the release date of the movie. They actually, as you probably figured, had planned the drop of Mal Goes to War around the release date of Mickey 17. And then Warner Brothers kind of, you know, foiled that plan by pushing it out. So now my next book, which is going to be called The Fourth Consort, is going to drop presumably right around the time, you know, that January 31st timeframe when the movie comes out.
Now, is that one that you finished, or is that one that you're writing right now?
That's the one. It's currently in copy edits. Okay. I just got my copy edits back from the publisher today, actually. So that's once we hang up here, that's my plan, is to go work on that for a while.
Gotcha. Well, I won't hold you too much longer then. I do have one more question that I ask every single author. I don't hate Amazon, but shout out to your favorite brick and mortar store, because I do love my independent bookstores.
So I got to be really careful here, because I have at least three favorite independent bookstores right around here, and I know all their owners and I love them, and I don't want to have any of them think that one of them is my favorite and one of them is
you
not.
You won't be the first author to mention multiples. Go for it.
Yeah. So Liffridge Bookstore in Brockport, I'm actually going to be on April 6th signing copies, like early release copies of Mal Goes to War at Liffridge. The Dog-Eared Book, which is in Palmyra in upstate New York. I guess those are the two, those are my two, sort of go-tos. There are a couple of others, around here that are maybe, like on a slightly lower tier of love.
Gotcha.
But yeah, those are the big ones.
He loves anybody who carries his book.
No, oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, if you're you know, if you're the Hudson book seller in O'Hare Airport, and I see a copy of my book on your shelf, you're my favorite bookstore for that day. Absolutely.
Gotcha. Well, I'll try to make sure. I'm pretty sure they're already going to carry it, but I'll try to make sure the bookworm here down in here at Omaha has it. So if anybody sees this and they want to pick up that book, we'll make sure they can get that copy for you. I think that was it. I have it right about an hour. This is usually what I aim for anyhow. Didn't look, I saw a couple people watching, but nobody actually commenting, which is fine. Book people are sometimes introverts. That is completely allowed. You don't have to ask questions if you don't want, but totally appreciate you stopping in. Thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Absolutely loved your book. I'm also going to make sure before the movie comes out, since we did talk about it briefly, I'm going to get Antimatter Blues read as well, because I have not read that one yet. But we will get that one taken care of. And like I said, anything that I don't already have down in the links below on YouTube, I will get added, including I will get links to the bookstores you mentioned. I always love to do the shout outs to the local independent bookstores. Those are the people, if you've ever got a book signed for you, you didn't get it from Amazon. You got it from the local independent bookstores who are putting out these author events now that COVID is over. and so that you can actually, I say over, you all know what I mean. But, you know, so you can actually get to meet these authors in person. Part of the reason I started this is because it was about 2 years after, I guess, the virus we're not actually supposed to name on YouTube so you don't get blocked happened. And I just really, really missed hearing the authors talk. So I decided to talk to you myself. So again, we're gonna let Edward go because he's got stuff to do. I appreciate everybody showing up. And if you showed up late, as soon as this ends, you can rewatch it. All right. Have a good one, guys.
Yep. Appreciate it.